Hello, Blogging Heads Nation. I am Daniel Dresner. I am a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. I blog at foreignpolicy.com, and I'm the author of Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
And hello, Blogging Heads Nation. I am Charlie Carpenter. I teach international affairs at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, Department of Political Science. I blog at Duck of Minerva. And Laurie Skenzamoney, and I am a huge fan of Theories of International Politics and Zombies.
Why, thank you, Charlie. Although you also might be its most powerful critic. We'll get to that in a second. I should note that for once we are actually playing to stereotype. We had originally recorded this on Friday, but due to technical difficulties that did not work out terribly well. So this being a Saturday night, we as bloggers are naturally wearing our pajamas, in fact.
Yes. And it being Saturday night, drinking.
Exactly, yes. So what is your beverage of choice?
Oh, I've got a lovely Shiraz here.
Ah, I'm doing the tawny port thing, so...
lovely.
It'll be nice to finish this bottle off.
So this should be even more fun than it was on Friday.
Exactly. This will definitely get more creative as the hour goes along.
I hope so.
We should open, however, with, I'm glad to hear you say that you were a fan of the book, because I believe you offered... what might be the most powerful criticism of the book I've seen.
Well, I'm not a fan of zombies.
I understand.
I'm a great fan of what you've done in the book, but I must confess, an anti-zombite.
I understand that. For those of you who have not seen this, I will urge you to click on the link on the right, which will hopefully take you to Charlie's a YouTube video, which was essentially... Charlie's critique of my book at the International Studies Association meeting that was held 2 weeks ago, which it was a very successful roundtable.
On a roundtable, by the way, I don't know if you caught this in my blog post, but which was the most tweeted about event at the entire conference, everything in the entire Twitter feed on the hashtag ISA2011, zombies was like the fifth most tweeted term after like... ISA 2011, and a few other things like Bitly.
I did say that.
It's quite amazing what you've done.
It's very flattering.
In the field of political science.
Well, clearly it was popular because it was a standing room only panel, and I should also thank the organizer Stephanie Carbon at Royal Holloway, as well as Rob Farley of Lawyers Guns Money, Dan Nexon of Duck of Minerva. And Jeremy Ude of the University of Minnesota, I believe, who is a public health expert. And all of you really all brought your A-games to this panel. And I would also add the audience brought their A-game. There were some great and very imaginative questions, I think, that came through.
Every question. It was great. Everybody was so deadpan.
Yeah.
But I think it really was the topic of zombies and the fact that you have this title in a very serious and nerdy program of papers on very serious topics. I think it's the lightheartedness and the unexpectedness and the way in which you manage to deal with this topic in such a serious manner. And the way it's inspired people in the profession to take ourselves a little less seriously.
Well,
but also think hard about what our theoretical frameworks can tell us about the kinds of new threats that we're facing as we move into the 21st century.
Well, and this leads naturally into your criticism, which was a very powerful one, in which you argued that I had taken the wrong threat, that I had focused too much attention on zombies. And you, in your opinion, there is another threat out there that I did not devote enough attention to, or that even, furthermore, the zombies were a distraction, perhaps.
I fear that might be the case. I mean, prove me wrong.
Well, you have to make your argument for those who haven't seen the video. So, just in brief, what are you saying?
So, well, I mean, you have to take the video in context. Stephanie Carbon, whose idea this roundtable was, bless her heart, told everybody we had to dress in zombie costumes for the panel. And so, I'm an anti-zombie. I don't want to dress in a zombie costume. I think zombies suck. And so I told her I'll come in costume. But I decided I was going to dress as something else, something that would actually be a better metaphor and provide more purchase on IR theory. And so I wanted to be like a really badass cyborg chick, like Seven of Nine, or maybe a cyborg hunter, like Sarah Connor. And as you know, I came with the Battlestar Galactica motif because that's I'm writing a paper on that. But
you were being very modest. Your costume was incredibly intimidating, I have to say.
Well, thank you very much. I think everybody looked great on the panel. But so there was an element of pure satire.
Yes.
And then I wanted to link it to my actual substantive critique of your book, which is sort of the absence of alternative frameworks. You know, we've covered realism, liberalism, constructivism, some theories which really aren't theories, like neoconservatism, and gone into quite a bit of depth on certain sort of niche areas. But there's no attention to critical theory, there's no attention to feminist theory, et cetera, et cetera. So I made, perhaps rather speciously, the argument in the panel that had you only picked cyborgs, you would have been able to engage these other alternative theories much better, and that the fact that you did not do so might actually mean that you're in league with the cyborgs. They're just trying to distract us with zombies. Of course, that's just... You know, the panel went from sort of more serious with Rob Farley doing these amazing empirical presentations on how his zombie simulations with his students have sort of been able to, he can test the hypotheses that you propose in your book against this data he's got. So we went from sort of serious research to increasingly more farcical, and of course I ended with my accusations that you might be a cyborg.
I think you're sorely underestimating the impact of your presentation, because I have to say in my 14 years as in this business, that was one of the few moments where I was literally rendered speechless. It had never occurred to me that I might in fact be a sleeper Cylon agent. And this entire thing was just sort of an evidence of mass distraction from.
And now that you've become aware of this, Dan.
Yes.
I mean, what are you going to do next? I mean, have you told your wife? Is she aware?
Well, you know, I went for a long walk, and I thought, could this be the case that I'm actually a sleeper Cylon? And I decided in the end that I'm going to stick by my metaphor. That I appreciate the point you raised in the talk, which is that it's in many ways cybernetic threats or cyborgs might be a more viable concern. That is, as society evolves, you're increasingly seeing things like, you know, mechanized warfare, robots being used to basically replace human beings on the battlefield in the form of, you know, UAVs and drones and other sorts of weapons, as well as the ways in which even civilians are integrating themselves further into computers and cybernetic devices. Indeed, we're engaged in this very thing by doing this blogging heads. So I thought that was an interesting critique. That said, I do think I want to stick with the zombies for a couple of reasons.
The first
is that even if you're right, even if in fact the cyborgs are the more serious threat, you know, based on, in some ways the zombies chose me rather than vice versa, which is to say there was a spike in interest in zombies that wasn't matched by, there was an increase in output, but it didn't quite match the spike in interest. So in that sense, I thought, even if you think that cyborgs are the real threat, you need to at least satiate the concerns and fears about the zombies. So in that sense, I thought my book, you know, at least is a building block. And, you know, I would like further scholars to build on my work. After all, political science and hope is hopefully a cumulative discipline, and therefore, you know, once we've dismissed the zombie threat, then people can focus on the cyborgs. That's the sort of mock answer. The more serious answer is that in some ways the thing that I'm really happy about with this book is that by focusing on zombies, I use something that was obviously in some ways so absurd, whereas I think your cyborg argument is actually an interesting one, because you're right. You can see it, you know, there are always all these questions about when we're going to reach the singularity and when, you know, you will actually have... you know, artificial intelligence is capable of sentience and so forth. So that's clearly conceivable and on the horizon. But in some ways, because it's conceivable, talking about cyborgs makes it too grounded in reality. By talking about zombies, it allows for that air of unreality in terms of thinking about the theories that actually allows people to become that much more creative in terms of, you know, what didn't I cover and, you know, did this theory actually get things right and so forth. And oddly enough, again, you know, part of what we do, the whole point of making theories is to abstract from reality. And in some ways, by using the zombies, because they're a more absurd premise, it allows everyone to think about these threats in a slightly more creative way, I think. Whereas I'm not sure that would have taken place with the cyborg question.
Well, we'll find out when you write your sequel on cyborgs, after I convince you. Well, okay, so to be serious, right, I think, again, okay, so you chose zombies because they're so farcical,
yeah,
rather than something that actually, where there's an empirical argument, sort of, where you can really make that case. And I think Rob Farley has made a similar argument on Blogging Heads that part of the way that zombies work is they're kind of so stupid and asocial and astrategic that you don't have to actually think about them as a genuine enemy. You can sort of abstract away from all of that and just think about how states would operate. You can sort of treat them as a pandemic, if anything. I guess I would say I don't think it's thinking about sort of how threatening, what's the real threat here, I think is not really the direction.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really the source of my critique. It's not that cyborgs are necessarily a greater threat. And I think that there are a lot of interesting changes afoot that need to be theorized.
Yeah.
And I think that these information, the information technology revolution, which, you know, I allude to in many different ways in the video, not just with cyborgs,
right,
has its tentacles into changes that are happening globally in ways that I'm not sure IR theorists are keeping up with well, although some more than others, right? So that's part of the argument. So I think it's not that, however. It's not that cyborgs are a greater threat. It's what do these different allegories represent, and to what extent do they work for you pedagogically or theoretically as a way to sort of present IR theory to policymakers and students in an accessible way. And what sort of elements of IR theory are you reproducing in your choice of an allegory? And I think, you know, I was asking myself in the lead up to this conversation, why am I anti-zombie? What bugs me about zombies as an allegory? Right, I mean, I'm not cool, I guess, because everybody's into zombies, right?
Well, not everyone. I mean, you know,
it's quite a craze.
Actually, no. In fact, I will tell you, you know, in some ways, if it makes you feel any better, you know, there are several IR scholars that clearly are not into these things. It's been very interesting watching the reaction, I think, of our profession to this book, because by and large, people have been very, you know, relatively enthusiastic about the project. But every once in a while, I run into someone who just comes up to me and says, "I don't get the zombies." And I have to admit, those wind up being I actually kind of think that's really funny, in that the people who generally seem to be flummoxed are the people that I frankly was expecting to be flummoxed. So, you know, I have no problem with that. But, you know, in your case, I actually am surprised, because I was expecting you to enjoy
it. Well, but why were you surprised? You're surprised because I'm into science fiction, I'm into using film and pop culture in my class, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Let me tell you why zombies bug me as an allegory for social relations in global society.
Okay.
And also then why I find cyborgs more interesting. So maybe I'll do it backwards. The first question for me is, to what extent does this allegory work? And I think cyborgs work better because they map onto the kind of systemic transformations in global politics that we're seeing just much better as an allegory. Zombies work to the extent that you think pandemics mm-hmm. are likely to be the big threat that challenges humanity in the near future. But when I look at the world, I don't see humans being pitted into national groups against marauding subhuman lethal threats in this way. I see the organization of humans into national groups being challenged at every turn by transnational information technologies. I see, you know, social media shifting the relationship between citizens and governments. And I see the very boundaries of what it means to be human or to interact in a human collective being challenged or changed by, you know, the outsourcing of war to machines or of social relations from the real world into cyber platforms, etc. So I know you've been thinking a lot about these trends too. You've done research on this. We've co-authored some research on this. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder to what extent you find that the zombie metaphor can work for those aspects, you know, transformations in global politics, because when I see the way you've used zombies in your book, you don't seem to capture that element terribly well, and neither does mainstream IR theory, frankly. Today, more than anything, what I see is a need for a lens on the world that can help us make sense of hybridity
mm-hmm.
and the way in which all the conventional distinctions that we're accustomed to that are the cornerstones of IR theory, like the domestic versus foreign, and civil versus military, and state versus nation, news versus entertainment, right? Theory versus policy. All of this is blurring, partly because of changes in information technology. You think of an actor like WikiLeaks, which has arguably had a very important effect on global politics. You can trace some of the revolutions that are happening in the Middle East to some of the WikiLeaks. And no one can make much sense over what WikiLeaks is, and that's part of the problem in dealing with it. What kind of actor is this? Is it an NGO? Is it a form of journalism? Is it a media outfit? Is it a criminal? I don't know. Stephen Colbert just this week established his first political action committee, right? So is that politics or is that satire? Is he fake news icons, political actors or entertainers? Everything seems to be up for grabs. A pastor in Florida can have this enormous effect on human security on the other side of the world. What does it mean to be at war with a terror network? And if you can be at war with a non-state network, how does that challenge the structure of international law? So I think these are some of the big questions at issue today that are driving a lot of policy debates. IR theory struggles to weigh in on them. And so when I look at zombies and at both the zombie metaphor and your presentation of IR theory, mm-hmm. your survey in your book, and the kind of lessons that all of this lends to foreign policy, because they operate more like germs than like political actors, I think what you get is a narrative that seems really very Cold War. Whereas what I'm hoping for is something that can help engage the kind of world we're actually moving into. So I guess I would ask, can the zombie metaphor do that? And if it can, why didn't you take it in that direction in your book?
Well, I would say in some ways, a few things is, first, what you're saying is basically where I wound up, I think, in the conclusion to the book. Because in the conclusion, I mean, you know, the conclusion was the one moment where perhaps it became a little less of a satire, where I actually said, you know what? I mean, on the one hand, these theories provide some interesting predictions, but on the other hand, maybe they're a little too state-centric. Maybe they're a little too rigid. Maybe they're suffering from a little rigor mortis intellectually in terms of the sort of dichotomies they make. And that therefore, in fact, you know, we do need to have some more interesting and more creative theorizing. So in some ways, at the end of the book, I'm somewhat sympathetic to the arguments you're making now about whether or not, you know, there does need to be these kinds of new theories. On the other hand, I might not be quite as enthusiastic about critical theory as you as a way of answering these questions. And you know, this goes back to sort of the kind of newer hybrid actors we were talking about. You know, if you think about WikiLeaks, for example, you know, the effect of WikiLeaks was interesting. I mean, there's no question it's a new actor. It's not something we've normally seen before. And it definitely did have real-world effects. But I would note that the real-world effects were not exactly what Julian Assange intended the real-world effects to be, or the other creators of WikiLeaks. That clearly, it seems that Assange thought that the publication of these documents would lead to, you know, serious repercussions in the United States, and, you know, a clear fraying of relationships between the United States and other actors out there. And the interesting thing is that what wound up happening is that WikiLeaks kind of functioned in some ways like a pandemic or like a natural disaster, which is that the strong and open societies did relatively well in weathering the WikiLeaks storm. It's not to say they weren't affected, but, you know, by and large, there were a few resignations. There were a few, you know, there were some media cycles of interest. And then, you know, nowadays I think WikiLeaks is, let's face it, if it makes the news, it's in the back page of the newspaper or, you know, in a very obscure part of the website. On the other hand, the places that were affected were, you know, the weaker and more authoritarian states, as you say, that in some ways it didn't play the role, but it played a supporting role in the revolution that took place in Tunisia. And this suggests to me that there are ways in which the state, you know, these conventional theories still can say something. And, you know, as much as I was satirizing or, you know, critiquing these paradigms, I was doing it from a place of, you know, for lack of a better way of putting it, love. I know, it's very sweet. A sort of recognition that these theories are flawed in many ways and it would be nice to improve them. But that said, I also don't think they're useless, which is why I you know, did this in the first place. And it's not obvious to me that critical theory is necessarily going to have a leg up in terms of addressing these new kinds of phenomena. I mean, I'm willing to be persuaded otherwise on this, Charlie.
So for example.
Okay. Charlie?
Yeah, I'm here. Oh. I'm sort of putting my words together. Though I wouldn't mind taking a short break and refilling my wine glass. Would that be a huge blocking his scope?
Let's pause for station identification and alcohol refilling.
So I guess my response to that would be to say that the point of critical theory is not to explain the world in the same way that or predict what states will do in the same way that your other frameworks did. The point of critical theory is to force the theorist or the student or the policymaker to step back and check their assumptions. And so the first thing that your chapter on critical theory in your second edition probably wants to do is to question the zombie allegory. Sorry? Mm-hmm.
It'll be called the revived edition.
Okay. Very good. Perfect sense.
Thank you.
Anyway, I mean, to sort of question what the zombie allegory does or doesn't do, is it appropriate? I mean, Dan Nexon made all kinds of interesting sort of post-modern critiques in his presentation on the panel where he said, you know, the very selection of zombies over other creatures, wizards, vampires, etc., it has got power relations in it. I mean,
Dan accused me of being too anthropomorphic in my theory, that I was too pro, you know, human-based, yes.
You were so pro-human. I mean,
at least I was explicitly pro-human.
Which is fair enough. I'm a human security analyst. I, too, am pro-human, okay?
I was going to say, you of all people should not have criticized me of being pro-human. But
I'm anti-zombite in a human-zombie war. I want humans to win. But here's the thing. Here's what the zombie metaphor does that a critical theorist might find problematic, and I find problematic. And my co-blogger, Vikash Yadav, has made this argument. What the zombie metaphor encourages us to do, because zombies are so brainless and mindless and easy to dehumanize, is they encourage us to think of the enemy as subhuman. And they think that this is actually a huge problem in human relations, especially when you're at war, is the tendency to dehumanize. So, I mean, you could begin with that. You could think about how the simplicity of the frameworks that you offer is in part, as Rob Farley argued, contingent on that. And then ask how useful is that actually for social relations among human beings. I mean, there's a whole critique of the standard IR frameworks right there and the kinds of things that they lead to. So I guess what I would say is, you know, I'm not saying that I don't think a discussion of the other theories is important. It's absolutely important. I just think that critical theory is a really good check on some of the thinking that those theories lead to and some of the assumptions, because the desire to simplify the world doesn't necessarily leave us with good frameworks for addressing the key issues of our time, right? So I think that policymakers...
Well, but sometimes even those theories wind up getting simplified.
Sure.
And, you know, this is a nice segue, for example. You know, I mean, over the last week, and basically since the U.S. launched or contributed to Operation Odyssey Dawn, you know, there's been this meme out there that apparently what can explain U.S. operations in Libya is, as it turns out, feminism, or rather women in particular. That, you know, there's been a lot of articles or blog chatter. I think the most egregious was something written in the Daily Beast, you know, pointing out that, wow, gee, it turns out that the advisors that you recommended to President Obama that he use military force in Libya were all women. You know, Hillary Clinton, Susan Rice, Samantha Power. So this really seems to puzzle because, you know, it obviously contradicts standard feminist theory.
Yeah, obviously, because feminist theories all think that women should rule the world, and if they do, well, the world would be a more peaceful place and we'll never go to war. Right, feminist theory came up with that. Right? And it's the feminists who seem to be...
I know for a fact you wrote in Foreign Affairs the ways in which this is so wrong. So please go ahead.
I mean, where to start? I mean, Obama made the decision, right? Obama's a guy, right? He's the one who made the decision.
As far as we know. We certainly know he's Kenyan. I mean, I don't, you know, beyond that.
We know that three important women in the administration supported an intervention in Libya to save civilians. We also know that significant men in the administration, to say Obama himself included, shared the same view and were willing to act on it. We know that there's plenty of women out there who don't agree with this intervention, and that there's some very important men in the administration who weren't sure, who had a different view of what was in the national interest. And from that, we have this wide-ranging argument that somehow the Amazons are driving the foreign policy of the country, and that this is somehow to the detriment of the nation. And I think what feminist, and that this is not what feminist theory would predict. This is such a vacuous understanding of what feminist IR has been about. First of all, feminist IR theorists would be the first to show empirically that, in fact, the women in peace stereotype is mostly a myth. And secondly, they would not focus on what individual women think or do in an administration. They would be focusing on the way in which these kinds of myths are being used politically. And the notion that Obama must have been henpecked to have made a decision to go in on a humanitarian intervention is simply being used by his detractors to try to make him look bad. And why that would make him look bad is just wrapped up in what we consider certain appropriate standards of masculinity for leadership in this particular political culture we live in. So feminist theorists, yeah, they would actually have a lot of insight, and I think Laura Schoberg at Duck of Minerva, my co-blogger, has had some very useful and concise and accessible insights about what those things would be. But I guess I would say that this underscores why you need to have a feminist theory chapter in your book, because your book is accessible, and your book is going to be read by policymakers and by students and by a lot of people who probably would never have picked up a feminist theory book if they weren't forced to by their professor in their advanced international relations seminar. You have an opportunity to sort of make this very complex set of theories and theoretical insights accessible to a lot more people who clearly could use those insights to interpret what's going on in our foreign policy in a little bit less of a stereotypical way.
Okay. I mean, a few things on this. First of all, I recommend everyone read Charlie's foreignaffairs.com essay that sort of takes issue with the sort of very, very simplified version of, oh, how could women be in favor of using force? I had two responses reading that. The first was, again, whether or not women might, you know, whether or not there is a gender breakdown, not so much in whether or not women want to use force, but rather the motivating reasons behind using force, which is that women might be more interested in using force for the protection of civilians, to avert humanitarian catastrophes, these kinds of things. And then the second thing, and this is the thing that I'm kind of interested in a deeper sense, is whether or not the interesting thing here is not so much what these women wanted in terms of the use of force, but rather whether there are certain foreign policy trajectories that get shaped by gender, for lack of a better way of putting it. For example, you know, to use an example that I know of in the economics profession, generally speaking, you know, the joke when I was in an econ PhD program was that all women go into labor, meaning that all women went into labor economics. And similarly, it's interesting to wonder whether or not women, in terms of the career choices they face, wind up choosing, you know, different elements of the security spectrum. They will slightly, you know, steer away from what used to be sort of considered very hard security, sort of standard guns and bombs things. And as a result, does this cause foreign policy professionals that are women to have slightly different policy preferences, not because they're women, but because, or rather only indirectly because they're women, which is to say because they're women, they chose a slightly different career track, and that's what shaped their policy.
Those are really interesting questions, Dan. I don't know. Let me answer them backwards again. And first to say that my sense of what's happening in this Valkyries case is all of these women, Rice, Power, and Clinton, they came into their positions from very different trajectories. So I'm not sure that that works in this case, which isn't to say it doesn't work generally.
I think what happened
in this case is that they all came, if there's anything generalizable is in terms of variation between them and the foreign policy doves on Libya, these CIA-trained, right.
Bob Gates, obviously, and others, yeah.
Those guys came into, they were socialized during the Cold War. They were socialized through the intelligence community. Rice, Clinton, and Power were socialized much later into foreign policy at around the turn of the century in the 1990s, during the time when we were watching the Rwandan genocide. Failing to intervene in Bosnia effectively, and then we had the good war in Kosovo, and then we had the responsibility to protect doctrine that came out of that. And so they were very much networked into these kinds of diplomatic circles where that kind of discourse was seen as progressive and important. And of course, it all went by the wayside during the Bush administration, but now it's back, baby, right? So, I mean, I think that there's possibly a social disconnect and an ideological disconnect that's almost generational in that sense. And it has much more to do with that than it has to do with gender. But your question, your broader question is actually quite interesting. It's not something I've studied closely or that I know the literature on well enough to say that I know the answer. I will say that there are interesting statistics I've read and things I've heard anecdotally that, you know, viewers can follow up on if they want. And one of them is, you know, the NGO sector, at least it was, tended to be more feminized than the state sector. So that's interesting. States are much more feminized in terms of, you know, ministries and federal agencies than are international organizations. International organizations tend to be very masculinized in terms of the gender breakdown. I don't know what to make of that. I mean, go look it up. It'd be interesting to look at the scholars that are tracing these kinds of effects. Someone told me, and I can't even remember who, and I haven't read this. This wasn't out of a study. This was someone's. This is hearsay. Someone who works in the nuclear security establishment mentioned to me that in recent years, the nuclear security community has become increasingly female dominated. But so what, this leads to another interesting question, right? So it's sort of the reverse of what you're asking. You're asking, are women socialized into certain professions because they tend to be female dominated? The reverse of that is, and what feminists would focus on is, what do we value in society, and how do the things that we value, the things that we pay more for, the things that we attach prestige to at a particular point in time, how do they map onto notions of masculinity or femininity that are attached to them? And during the Cold War, the nuclear security establishment was very masculinized. It was like the dominant thing is where you wanted to be if you were going to be a mover and shaker. But now, I mean, nuclear deterrence is so delegitimized. Obama's talking about disarming. Everybody hates the notion of nuclear weapons. And where you want to be if you're moving and shaking in foreign policy is not necessarily there. So maybe. I don't know. I don't actually study that. So... it's another way of asking the same question. And I guess what I'm saying is the notion of how gender interacts with security policy is much more complex than saying, oh my God, we have a female Secretary of State and she's dragging us into a war. It must be because she's a woman, and oh my God. It's much more complex than that. And then to come to your other question, again, on complexity, I mean, what you got in the Foreign Affairs article is actually quite watered down. I mean, if people are interested in following up on that, please email me. And or check out the actual studies in question. I think everything in there is a caricature. You know, even I said Sarah Ruddick is a feminist peace theorist. And it's true, but she doesn't actually argue women are peaceful either. What she argues is that mothering, the practice of mothering, whether by men or women, engenders an ethic of care that makes you less likely to go to war. I don't think that's empirically true. But at any rate, you can see that's more nuanced than the kind of discourse that we're hearing out of the Beltway. But on this notion of the gender gap, it's very interesting. There is a gender gap in foreign policy. Women are slightly, depending on how you look at it, the gap is like 12% across a range of foreign policy questions on the use of force. Women are about 12% less likely than men to support the use of force, which is, it's not a huge gap in my mind. The gap shrinks to like 4% on questions of humanitarian intervention. And two things are happening there. Both men and women would prefer to use force to intervene to save civilian lives than they would to pursue wars for other reasons, both men and women. But women feel more strongly about it than men. So men feel more strongly, but women feel more strongly yet, and so the gap between them on the use of force shrinks to 4%. That's what the data shows when you look across many surveys. And so, I mean, I think that's a very nuanced finding. I think that you're dealing with things at the margins. I think if you look at any man and woman in American society, it's not very easy to use sex to predict their foreign policy preferences. And I think that there are a lot of good reasons, having nothing to do with sex or gender, to feel that it's in our national interest to prevent genocide abroad when we have the ability to do so at a reasonably low cost. So there you have it.
Well, this leads to the next topic, of course, which is to what extent do you think the Libya intervention will, to what extent does it reify or at least reinforce the norm of responsibility to protect, or R2P. There's been a lot of back and forth on this, that critics of the intervention have said, well, this just makes a mockery of R2P because, yeah, sure, the U.S. intervened in Libya, but they haven't intervened in other places where you've seen the repression of civilians, namely Bahrain or Syria or Sudan, for that matter. So why hasn't, clearly what's going on here is an evisceration of the R2P norm. I think you had a small piece in Small Wars Journal pointing out that this indicates a lack of understanding of the R2P norm.
Yeah, sorry. Kids poke in their head in the door. Okay. So the argument that because we're selective, or NATO is being selective, that it's counter to the norm, that's just completely specious. I would encourage people making that argument to actually read the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty report that outlined the responsibility to protect doctrine in the first place. The RTP doctrine is selective. It's designed to be selective. It is not designed to be capricious. Just cause, you could argue there's just cause in a lot of different places for an intervention of this type, but just cause is one of the six or seven criteria that have to be met, and one of them involves Security Council authorization or some form of multilateral consensus. These are not supposed to be unilateral interventions. One of them involves sort of an assessment of what the side effects are going to be. Is the good that's going to come from the intervention going to outweigh the civilian lives that are inevitably going to be lost through the use of military force, or is this going to end into an enormous conflagration of some kind? There's a number of different criteria that are attached, and I would argue that in this case, Obama gets a pass, and NATO gets a pass for actually following R2P to the letter, to the point of telling the Libyan rebels, reminding them, look, we're not on your side, we're on the side of civilians, and if you massacre civilians, we're going to shoot at you as well. So I think a lot of these critiques that this is just imperialism, this is just selective, I don't think it holds. As critiques of R2P, that doesn't, or as critiques of Obama's adherence to R2P, that doesn't hold water. As critiques of R2P, maybe. And I think, the question about the broader impact on the norm, of course, this is a test case for the R2P norm. R2P was articulated after Kosovo, sort of between Kosovo and 9/11. It was the notion of humanitarian intervention fell by the wayside throughout the Bush years. Now it's back. This is the test case. We'll see. And we'll see if, as a result of how Libya plays out, and we don't know how that'll go yet, as a result of how it plays out, I would imagine there will be another iteration of reassessment of that norm and what its principles should be. And one of the arguments that I find ethically interesting, I don't know where I stand on it, is that we should be going, maybe it was right to go into Libya based on the current criteria, but maybe the criteria are missing something, which is maybe we should be more likely to intervene in a place like Bahrain where the protests are still nonviolent, rather than a place where the protesters quickly armed themselves and engaged in a civil war. Perhaps we should be more readier to intervene on behalf of nonviolent protesters and intervene early enough that they can get help before they have to resort to force. I think you could make different arguments about that point, but certainly that is an argument many people are making, and I would be interested to see if it carries enough sway that the R2P principles might be updated after Libya.
I strongly suspect that the norm won't evolve in that direction for two reasons. One is practical, and one is sort of perceptual, for lack of a better way of putting it. The perceptual problem is to intervene before, things hit a crisis point, or before, the opposition takes up arms, you have to make the counterfactual that if intervention doesn't take place, there will be, mass atrocities. This is really hard to do. And in fact, Tom Malinowski has tried to make this argument, I think, in the New Republic with respect to Libya, saying, look, if the Obama administration had not intervened when they had, there would have been a massacre in Benghazi. Maybe it wouldn't have been 100,000 dead, but you're talking at least tens of thousands of dead and lots of refugees flooding in Egypt, which would not have been good. That's possible, but the problem is that it's always really – it's very difficult to justify going in militarily because of a counterfactual. And so I'm not sure you can make that argument all the time and it'll be terribly saleable. The second problem, I think, is actually practical, which is if the opposition hasn't taken up arms, if even though there's mass protests, there is still a coherent state there, then the problem with R2P becomes that if you actually, I mean, you can try to pressure the regime, you try to sanction them and so forth, but in the end, the ne plus ultra of this is using military force, and the fact is it's going to be a lot costlier and a lot more expensive to use military force against a coherent state rather than one that has actually been divided. I mean, as bad as what might be happening in Libya is, you know, it was clear that there was enough opposition to Gaddafi for people to actually rise up, start off with peaceful protests, and then when Gaddafi, you know, tried to crack down, actually then, you know, took up arms. So in some ways you can argue that in and of itself was an interesting criteria to meet, whereas if that doesn't happen, trying to intervene militarily leads to much greater loss of civilian life, I would imagine.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, well, I mean, that's an interesting counterpoint. And there are other counterpoints, right? I mean, the humanitarian law asks you to come down on the side of civilians in any case. And that's no less the case when their leaders have taken up arms against the state. So I think that there are... I honestly don't know where I would come down in the debate ethically, but I do think that sometimes you end up with norms that don't really meet ethical criteria, but they become... it's socially embedded in the structure of international society for other reasons. And so I think it's really going to be interesting to follow this and see what the answer to your question is ultimately. So will you?
I mean, let me ask. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to segue back to zombies, but if you have another point on Libya, go right.
Oh, no, go ahead. Segue back to zombies. I'm always happy to talk about them.
Well, if you write in your revised version of A Theory of International Politics and Zombies, will you have something to say about humanitarian intervention and norms? And gender.
I'm not sure. Well, I mean, I did talk about that a little bit in the liberal chapter, where I talked about, you know, how the creation of a global counter-zombie regime would probably lead to sort of, you know, UN-style peacekeeper or counter-zombie missions in the developing world, and that might actually lead to counter-zombie policy fatigue. And in some ways, it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in Libya, because it increasingly looks in Libya like it'll be a stalemate, at least in the short term, which leads to a whole bunch of interesting questions, including whether, you know, then you met the R2P standard because there's going to be ongoing conflict, or whether, you know, such a stalemate is a satisfactory outcome in terms of on the one hand, you actually have an eastern Libya that is relatively free from Gaddafi's yoke. On the other hand, you have Western Libya, which is not, and then, you know, the question will always be, should you
It's really interesting. I mean, I'm going back to Libya now, and we can come back to zombies later if you want to wrap up, but it's really interesting to me. The R2P doctrine doesn't really say anything about what the endgame should be, so which is another indicator that Obama is following it to the letter, right? But it also...
And that he's not thinking about the endgame.
Well, no, I think that he probably has an endgame in his pocket.
I think he's got an endgame that he wants. I'm not sure if he.
Well, I'm not sure that the fact that we don't know how it plays out means he doesn't know how it plays out. I actually think my impression of Obama is that he's extremely savvy and he's got extremely good advisors. And this notion, you know, that he flip-flopped at the last minute on Libya, I don't buy it. I think that he waited till the last minute to do what he was planning to do to make sure. Yeah.
Oh, I agree that he's. I don't think he flip flopped. I do think he's incredibly deliberate.
I'd like to see how it plays out. But anyway, what I will say is that you know, there's all this talk. Certainly, there's all this talk about how we aren't going to do regime change. And what's interesting, again, sort of using the R2P norm as a barometer, my interpretation of it is that it actually doesn't preclude regime change. And in fact, the whole idea behind responsibility to protect is that you lose your sovereignty when you commit or prepare to commit crimes against humanity, against your own population. So from a normative perspective, it's a little bit of a puzzle to me why they're not pushing, you know, just to out Gaddafi a little bit more forcefully. And so I'm sure that it's always an interplay between morality and politics. And so it's just fascinating.
I would agree with you that is essentially one of the implications of the R2P doctrine, which is why, by the way, Russia and China are not so keen on it.
They have other reasons. I mean, they have very good reasons for being concerned about this doctrine.
Yeah.
I don't think we should whitewash those reasons. I mean, R2P bumps up against another very important norm that has protected a lot of civilian lives for the last 60 years, and that's the non-territorial, the territorial aggression norm, the UN Charter. and the notion that we just don't attack governments unless they attack us. And that has kept the peace between the great powers, in part, that and nuclear weapons.
Yes.
For a long time, and it's right that governments in the international community be invested in it. So, they're walking on a tightrope here with R2P, and I think it's a fruitful and productive thing to see the international community doing. But it's a dance that could easily, from a normative perspective, speaking of someone who understands, who follows norms in particular, it's tricky. It's a tricky thing that's being accomplished here, and there's no guarantee how it's going to turn out. I'm here.
Charlie?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I'm like getting static on the reception. Unfortunately, I think we might need to wrap
I'm
this
ready,
up
actually. I think we've been at it for a while, and I know that my partner has poked his head in the door a few times. It's kind of late here on a Saturday night.
I understand. We are once again not only thank the Blogging Hands audience for watching, but we thank our respective spouses for tolerating this kind of tomfoolery. And
so say we all.
So say we all. So, but once again, a pleasure as always, Charlie. And these are very provocative questions that will have to be addressed by the Blogging Hands community as well as I think the international.
Great talking to you as always, Dan.
Okay, I enjoyed it too, Charlie.